episode 15 of the Bomber Brothers podcast is here, the Thurman Munson episode. It's also report card day. Sean and Ryan with you here to give out some end of the year grades to the Yankees. And then we also have Dr. Tommy John Jr. on to talk with us, and perfect timing as we're in the wake of the news of the Didi Gregorius injury. He underwent successful Tommy John surgery today, and Tommy John Jr. is going to come by and tell us all about what to expect with this recovery process, what is behind the spike in Tommy John surgeries, what it's like for position players to go through their recoveries. And Sean, he brought up a lot of really interesting points, especially when it comes to the recovery process for position players. I'm looking forward to playing that interview.
Yeah, it was a good talk with Dr. Tommy John Jr., but I left definitely a little bit scared after some of the stuff that he said. And I guess that's apropos because I was always scared of report card day. And here we are on report card day.
Yeah, I used to try to run and beat the mailman and hide it for an extra day or two. But the Yankees cannot hide from our report cards, as we are going to be dishing out the grades. And we're going to start, as we jump right into it, with I'm sure the person you're most eager to give out a grade to, the manager, Aaron Boone. Now, bear in mind, as we record here on October 17th, this would technically be the day that Boone gave us one of our best childhood moments, because it was after midnight. The game started on the 16th, but on October 17th, Boone did hit that home run off Wakefield, and you know, one of the reasons why he probably has a job right now.
Yeah, I kind of ranted about that last week. All right, you want to just talk about that since it's the 15-year anniversary real quick?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, let's start with something positive before we get into the Boone grades.
Let's delay the inevitable, kind of keep the suspense up. One of the things I will always remember, as much as he likes to bring it up, is our father said right before the inning started, Boone's going to hit a home run on the field. I think he called the first pitch, if I remember correctly.
I think so.
And sure enough, Wakefield throws his knuckle, as we all knew it was coming, and boom, it's gone. That was a wild game, probably one of the last true classic games that we got in the old format that we're used to before the dominant bullpens existed. But what are your memories about that game? And we can get into that.
I remember, it's funny because I think about watching this year's ALDS and just how it was, you know, inning 1 through 9, no matter what the score was, just so tense and almost feeling exhausted after the game just because of how nervous you are, because you follow the team all year and you're so emotionally invested. And of course, I was, you know, I feel I was just as invested in 2003, and I remember that season well. And the only difference was, even after the heartbreak in 2001, I still was under that, you know, naive, childish mentality that was kind of, you know, brought on by the Yankees winning all the time. And that I just remember watching the game and never even when they were down 5-2 in the eighth, never thinking they were going to lose. I remember you came home from your friend's house and you were all miserable and you just walked in the door and you said Soriano sucks because he was having an awful game. But like, even like
I rode my bike. All right. So Soriano in the bottom of the seventh hits that little tapper to end the inning. I think the bases were loaded in the bottom of the seventh.
Mm-hmm.
And I rode my bike from Alex's house to our house, which is probably what, a half mile?
Maybe. It was not very far.
Yeah, before the commercial break even ended. And I saw then David Wells give up the solo shot to Ortiz. But yeah, I was really pissed at Alfonso Soriano. I didn't remember saying that, but now that you mention it, yeah, that's definitely a me thing to do.
But and you were 3 years older than me at the time, so you had more realistic knowledge. And me, I was still pretty young and just kind of under the impression that the Yankees always were going to come back. And I just,
you know, you I don't mean to cut you off. You said that, and that's actually, it's funny that you said that, because that was the first postseason where the opposing team would get a runner on second, and I would get really nervous, like that tension would click in. 0-1 didn't do it to me, but then after they lost to the Angels in 0-2, that really is what put that kind of I didn't take the World Series being for granted anymore. So that was the first year that I actually felt that when watching the playoffs, and it was with the Twin Series that year too, and then the World Series after that. It wasn't just that Boston series. And So it was funny that you said that. But yeah, that was a really tense, very intense series.
Yeah, that was just that first, you know, we were at the ALCS in 99, but that was still kind of a beat down. The Yankees just were unstoppable then. But then that Red Sox team in 2003 was so good. And just all those hard-fought games that series, it was kind of our first introduction to the real nitty-gritty of that rivalry. And I mean, just even in the regular season in those years when those teams played was just must-see TV. And of course, it culminated in that eighth inning, which I still probably would... It's so tough. I could consider it my favorite inning of baseball I've ever watched, just that comeback, and to have it happen against Pedro, and just the whole, you know, oh shit realization when Grady Little went out and walked back to the dugout by himself and didn't take him out. And I'll never forget that night. I'll never forget the day after in school, me and you, we like wore plain white Yankee shirts, but like taped Boone and the number 19 on the backs of our shirts or something.
Actually, what I did was I had the shirt. It was white with the red writing that said Babe, Bucky, Buckner. I took a piece of paper and taped it because I didn't want to write on the shirt, and wrote Boone on a piece of paper at the bottom. And then my friend Vinny had the same exact shirt, and he actually just wrote it in permanent marker. Boone. And like everybody at school the next day was like people I didn't even know were Yankee fans or were in Yankee stuff. It was awesome. And you know, the home run itself is such a classic moment, but that eighth inning is I mean, if I could be any age and be at any inning, I'd be able to realize what was going on and go. I mean, I do remember what was going on, but I was 8 years old. 96, that the third inning would probably be the inning I would go to. But for understanding like the gravity of the situation,
Nice Corazon reference.
Yeah, thank you. That's probably the one inning I'd go back and relive, if I could relive any inning in the history of my fandom.
Yeah, you had the game tying hit by Posada, you had the game winning home run by Boone, but I will still say that Mariano Rivera and Mike Mussina are your two MVPs of that game, and then Jason Giambi also in there. Just so many people came up with big moments, and I think if I could remember a time when I actually was a little nervous, it was when Clemens was letting it get away early. But then Mussina came in and just put an immediate stop to it, and that's kind of settled me down. I was like, okay, you know, they're still going to win this thing.
Yeah, I think after Jeter gets the double, it was just kind of that here we go moment. But I definitely I didn't feel that, because they really never had anything going against Pedro. I mean, Giambi hit the two solo shots, and then they in the seventh they got something going, and then they just squandered it with, you know, Soriano, and that's why I was so upset with him. I don't know. Definitely a classic game, and Boone's the hero, and Boone gets the job, and now it's time to grade Boone, I guess.
Yeah. So now here we are, 15 years later, and now Boone is still in the Yankee dugout, just in a different role, finishing his first year as manager. It obviously ended with a complete flop in terms of his in-game management, but the season as a whole, I don't even know if I need to ask, but what's your grade for Boone?
So I had some time to calm down. It's like everybody trying to calm me down.
So it's just a D minus.
I've had some time to calm down, and now I'm going by the grade that C is satisfactory. Okay.
Yeah.
So C is average. All right. It's not like Our House where if you get a C, you're punished until further notice, and if you have to plug in whatever you want to use, then you can't use it.
Yeah, for our listeners, that was our dad's famous punishment. If you were able to plug in something like a PlayStation or a TV, you weren't allowed to use it. And we would be able to get away with a lot if that was the rule today, because we would still have our cell phones and iPads.
Can't charge them, though.
That's true.
you get a couple hours out of it. All right, I would give Boone a D. I think he did a poor job. I don't think he completely failed. He's still in it, you know, in terms of his contract, and he can definitely bounce back. But I think he definitely kept the kind of fun vibe around the team for sure. I think he did a pretty good job at handling the press. And I thought And now, I thought for the most part, actually, I shouldn't say that. I had one issue with anything he did offensively, strategically, that I can think of, and that's good. I mean, his lineups usually made sense. I think he tried to get guys rest when he could. I think he rode Giancarlo a little bit hard, but I think he had to do that. My issue is with how he handled the pitchers. And I've, you know, he leaves starters in way too long. He punted a couple games away by going to his second or third level relievers when he should have been trying to keep the game close, especially down the stretch when they had a chance to still win the division. But his fail, so like if that was everything, I would have just given him a C because some good, some bad. But his failure to learn from his mistakes is what really drops him down to a D for me, because he kept making the same mistake over and over and over again, and that drove me nuts.
I think that's fair, and again, it's kind of, when you think of like regular season awards like MVP and Cy Young, you know, you have to leave out the playoffs. If we were grading just his playoff performance, I would probably give him an F. But overall, I'll give him a C, just satisfactory. I really don't think that his, over the course of the entire season, like you said, I totally agree. He punted some games away. I still don't think that would have played a huge part in the division race, considering how far back they finished. They lost the race because pitchers got hurt, and the luxury tax was such a necessity to stay under for whatever reason, and you got too many starts from guys like Sonny Gray and Domingo Germán. I like how Boone handled the lineup. Like you said, he pushed Stanton a little, but that's when he had to, when Judge got hurt. He had a lot of injuries to deal with in his first year. Totally agree with all the pitching staff problems and how they really came to a head at the worst possible time. But for me, honestly, a lot of that grade falls on Larry Rothschild, because he was supposed to be the one that stepped up and helped Boone in his first year as a manager, because Rothschild's been there before. And at least from our perspective, maybe it's different in the dugout, but from our perspective, Rothschild did a terrible job at that. I would give him a D or an F, but Boone gets a C for me. And I guess our grades average out to a C minus, D plus range. Now, how about up in the offices and Mr. Brian Cashman?
I'd give Mr. Cashman a solid B, maybe a B plus. Now I'm not going to give him any credit for. Well, all right, hold on, wait. Are we giving him credit for Torres and Andujar, even though he didn't get them this year?
No, we'll grade Torres and Andujar separately, because that wasn't a move that Cashman made in 2018.
Okay, so I'm going to give him a B plus, and it would have been an A plus, but he fired a manager that was one game from the World Series and picked up one that I just gave a D to. So that's his biggest. That was his biggest issue. The biggest issue I had with him this year was I think he made a very poor choice, and I think he had other better options than Boone to turn to that he didn't hire. And I'm very down on him hiring Boone. So that brings it down. I also think he didn't do enough in the off season to address the pitching staff. Their depth definitely was exposed until he did a very good job at going out and getting Hap. That was a good maneuver, but by not having the pitching depth at the beginning of the season, it wound up costing them the division, even though they did get Hap later. By then, it was too late.
I'm going to give Cashman an A. Just I still think he might be the best general manager in baseball. And, you know, he does get rid of a manager after they come one game from the World Series, but he also goes and gets the reigning NL MVP in the same offseason.
Well, that was thrown into his lap.
Advantage of it. And, and again, kind of like the same situation with my grade of Boone, I feel like a lot of the things that fans wanted to see Cashman go out and do were things he couldn't do because he was being held back by this luxury tax goal that the Steinbrenners were putting upon him. I still think Cashman tried to go and get Gerrit Cole, and the Pirates turned down his offer, and then the Astros jumped in and took him instead. And, you know, so be it. I'm sure Cashman did his due diligence during the deadline, approaching the deadline, to check in on guys like DeGrom, and the Mets probably were just like, you're the Yankees, we don't want to deal with you, because that's just how the Mets are. And then Cashman still wound up getting an incredible amount of production from Happ down the stretch. He got some solid innings out of Lance Lynn. And then he goes and gets a guy like McCutchen, who was basically, you know, finishing the season as a Yankee with an on-base percentage of like 900 or something ridiculous like that. So I think it was more of the same from Cashman, pulling the right strings and going out and getting what they needed to get. The only thing, and again, I don't know if this was more the Giants were asking too much initially and then brought the asking price down before the waiver deadline came to an end. I would have liked to have seen him pull the trigger on a McCutchen-like trade way earlier, because it was clear that Shane Robinson wasn't the solution. And the fact that he played a month is pretty much an abomination. But I'm giving Cashman a hard A.
All right. I think the manager thing is, you know, that's like missing an assignment. You know what I mean? You completely missed it. It's going to drag your grade down. But yeah, everything else that he did, you know, I understand that he had his limitations. And I mean, he always finds these diamonds in the rough, whether it be Voit, who comes and contributes. And, you know, he had Lynn, and, you know, Lynn Lynn did the job they got him to do. So, yeah, I thought he did a fine job in terms of player personnel. So, now let's talk about some of the guys that he did get. You want to start with Torres?
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we can even, for me, I can group Torres and Andujar in the same group and give them both an A, because these are two guys that are, two of the three top rookie of the year candidates in the league. Torres was absolutely incredible in May. And then he had the hip problem and took a little while to come back. And, Torres, he showed some clutch hitting, had a huge walk-off against the Indians, and Duhar, I mean, what else can you say? He almost hit 30 home runs. He was an absolute doubles machine, setting the Yankee rookie record. I know his defense was obviously a huge problem, and Cashman said today that he plans on having Andujar back at third base, which is a little scary, but we'll see how that evolves as the offseason goes along. But, you know, I'm also giving these grades based with expectations playing a part as well. I don't think anybody thought that the Yankees would get that kind of production from Andujar. And considering their previous third basemen were guys like Headley and Frazier, who weren't that great defensively either, and then you add that kind of offensive production from a rookie who a lot of people considered, you know, a free swinger, which Andujar is, but he also adjusted incredibly once pitchers started giving him all breaking balls. He adjusted beautifully and showed a lot of quality veteran at-bats at the plate. So the rookies get an A for me.
All right. I wish I had you as my teacher. I'm going to also give them a B+. Andujar offensively gets like A++. But his defense was that atrocious that I have to knock him down to a B+. Torres was a better all-around player, I would say, between the – I mean, he did have his issues that you would expect of a rookie on defense.
And on the bases.
he actually – his base runs is -1. That's pretty bad. But yeah. I thought he had more trouble adjusting offense. Sorry, the Astros just went back to back to tie the game.
And a belly to belly?
Oh, so... no, it went off the wall. Never mind. That was a John Sterling call.
Wow. I have a grade to give you.
it is off the wall. Torres, I thought Andujar did a great job of staying with what pitchers were doing to him. Torres, I think there was definitely an adjustment period combined with that hip. Even though he was a better all-around player, I think that those offensive woes kind of reared their head, but he did, you know, make that adjustment back. So I'd give them both a B+. I thought they did. So let's say B is good, so B+ is very good, right? So I thought they did a very good job.
That's solid.
By the way, Altuve broke it down. He thought he had a home run too.
Well, he's probably craving a home run after he got robbed of one in the first inning, so I can't blame him. But anyway, moving right along, let's just group this all into one for the sake of time. But the pitching staff, give me your rotation grade and your bullpen grade, which I'm sure are going to be vastly different.
Bullpen grade, I'm going to give an A-. Okay. I thought now I'm taking the whole Penn into consideration. If we're talking about the big guns, the guys that we wanted to count on, I'd probably give them an A, just with the missing plus being probably Britton. And then, you know, there was a couple struggles from Green and Robertson mixed in there. But overall, I mean, historic year for the bullpen. I don't know about you, but I felt like they weren't as locked down as they were last year. I definitely felt like we sprung a few leaks here and there when you weren't expecting to.
Yeah.
For the starting rotation, I'd give them a B. I know that's probably very surprising, but if you think about it, I mean, how many games were we out of, like, by the third inning because the starter just got absolutely rocked, except for when Tanaka had his couple of stinkers and, you know, so, I mean, I thought they did a good job at holding it together and keeping the team in it. I mean, even when they had Loaiza, Herman, I mean, they were still in the division race at that point. I thought they did a good job for keeping it in it. I mean, keeping in line with expectation. I don't mean they weren't, you know, they weren't a dominant rotation, but I thought they did a good job overall.
All right, I'm definitely with you on the bullpen. That was a historic deep bullpen. I think, you know, they get the A-minus range, the one drop-off being a guy like Canely who completely disappeared.
Yeah, but then, what I'm saying. I would bump it down for, like, Canely, and yeah. If you want to include...
But then you had a guy like Holder...
Yeah, no, absolutely.
Yeah, a guy like Holder helped bring it back up, and then the big guns like Robertson and Chapman, when healthy, they were effective. And then the rotation, I think this is where I'm going to be a harder grader than you for the first time. Rotation, I would, well, what grade did you give the rotation?
A B. I thought a B or a B minus.
Yeah, I would go around C plus because I think about their better starters, and even with Severino's incredible first half, that's about as poor he was for a long stretch in the second half. So, you know, he'll get maybe a B-ish from me. Same for Tanaka. He was great after he got off the DL, but early in the season he was shaky. And then you have the F of Sonny Gray, which definitely brings the group grade down. That one kid in the class.
I didn't even think about Sonny Gray when I went to grade that rotation. I'm so pissed off at him still. Yeah. I just tried to erase him. Thank God he's going to be relocated.
He's the guy in your group project that never shows up to help with the assignments, and he brings the group grade down. I also think Herman brings the grade down. He had that one incredible start against Cleveland, and then he was on that torrid strikeout pace, but then he fell off the cliff. So, I mean, Sonny was just so bad that he brings the whole group down. I mean, you have that cluster of Seve, Tanaka, and Sabathia that are in that B range.
I mean, Hap.
Oh, yeah, Hap too. Can't forget Hap. But Sonny was just so astronomically bad that it brings it down to about a C-plus for me. So, now, let's just do a couple big position players. We'll stick with the big trio that was supposed to hit 1,000 home runs of Stanton, Judge, and Sanchez. So just give me those three, how you would grade them each individually.
Okay.
I mean, we might not even have to do Judge. I would assume we both give him an A. When he wasn't hurt, he was
A plus.
Just, yeah, A plus for Judge. We don't even have to go into him. So Stanton and Sanchez.
Stanton, I would give a C plus to. Now, I'm just not comparing him to a replacement level player. I'm saying for Giancarlo Stanton, this is a C plus year, right? Just above satisfactory. He did hit .266 with a .343 on base. .343 on base is very good. .509 slugging, also very good. But I felt like there were times where he definitely needed to step up a little bit more than he did and shoulder the load. And maybe he wasn't ready for that in his first year. But overall, I thought he carried himself well his first year in New York. I think he just maybe wasn't, you know, there was an adjustment period for sure. And we saw A-Rod and his, now, not that Giancarlo Stanton's the kind of player that A-Rod is, or A-Rod was, excuse me. We definitely saw an adjustment period for A-Rod, and we see that sometimes with guys that first come over. But, you know, I'd say a C+. I think I didn't realize this watching, not having watched Giancarlo Stanton on the regular, but I'm surprised by how much of an incomplete hitter he is. He doesn't make the adjustments that Aaron Judge makes. I mean, the fact that they get compared to me is now pretty silly because when I watch them hit, you could see their approaches are so vastly different and that Aaron Judge is a far smarter hitter. than Stanton is, in my opinion. Stanton is a great mistake hitter, whereas Judge is more of a complete player. And I think that'll play out more as Judge gets older. But I, at the same time, I think Stanton's going to get better as he gets more comfortable. But I thought his year was fine, but nothing spectacular. So he gets a C-plus out of me. Sanchez, I'm going to give him a D. Definitely he had a poor year, but I think there's a lot of room for improvement. And, you know, this has been said a bunch, and you know, progression isn't linear, right? You're not going to just get better every single year. You're going to have your peaks and your valleys. And Sanchez just had a rough year, in all aspects of the game. The power is still there, obviously. The home runs he hit all seem to matter. I mean, think about it. He had the walk-off home run against Minnesota. He had the three-run shot off of Giles in that game in Houston. And he had that two- or three-run job to tie it against the Mariners in that one game. He hit some big homers, but, you know, I mean, a guy that has a 291 on base and a 406 slugging, I can't give you that great of a grade.
No, I won't go too much into Sanchez because I have the same grade as you. I would give him a D. Also expect that grade to go up a lot next year, because that's just not the hitter Sanchez is. People struggle sometimes for inexplicable reasons in their young careers. I mean, look at a guy like Roy Halladay. He struggled for no reason when he was young after a couple really good early years, and then he went off to a Hall of Fame career, and I still think Sanchez is one of the best catchers in baseball. It's funny to watch the playoffs now, and you realize, wow, Sanchez defensively for what he did in the playoffs was among the best, considering all other catchers and how they're performing in the playoffs right now. Sticking strictly to the playoffs, of course, Sanchez was worse in the regular season. But a D for me. Stanton, I would give a B. I agree there were definitely some high-leverage spots where he didn't come through, and he was clearly maybe gripping the bat a little tight and became more of a guess hitter. I didn't watch enough of him in Miami, but you look at the numbers, and it seemed like he was a patient hitter and didn't chase too much. I think he got out of that this year, which maybe could be just – first year in New York was pressing a little bit, but he still caught fire when the Yankees really needed him to, when Judge got hurt, and played a bunch of games in the outfield with a tight hamstring when Boone really didn't have any other options to go to because Shane Robinson was on the other side of the outfield. So a B for Stanton, excuse me. And that'll
what about Judge?
We both agree. We give him an A+.
Well, I got one more. I want to just point out, because I just want to point this out, I have another A-plus to give.
I would imagine it's going to be for a guy like Hicks, because I would give Hicks
yes,
an A-plus.
Yes, I would give Hicks an A-plus. I thought he had an amazing year. His walk rate was 15.5%.
Absolutely. A-plus for me, too. Hicks, I mean, he showed a lot. You think of how far he's come from when he first came over for John Ryan Murphy, I should remind you. Remember when everyone was mad because John Ryan Murphy was their favorite scrappy backup catcher, and now he can't even cut it in some minor league organizations, and Hicks has become one of the most valuable center fielders in the league. Another Cashman home run.
I'll always remember when Murphy hit that home run in Minnesota after A-Rod had the
three A-Rod run game. Yeah, that was a great moment, but I'll take Hicks instead. Thanks.
So, all right. Report cards are in.
Report cards are in. Now, if you were grading Didi Gregorius in April, it would have been an A++++ infinity. but now the Yankees will be without him next April because he just underwent Tommy John surgery today, and a lot of question marks hanging over the shortstop position for the Yankees. Some are even tweeting, has Didi played his last game as a Yankee, which is, you know, really sad to think about considering how much he's meant to the organization since he came over and took over for Jeter. But a lot of questions to be answered, and we had Dr. Tommy John Jr., son of former Yankee Tommy John. He came on to shed some light as to what to expect for Gregorius in his recovery process, possible timetables, what challenges position players face after going under the knife for Tommy John surgery. And what do you say we play that interview right now?
Let's go.
All right, here's Dr. Tommy John Jr., and he stopped by to talk to us about the spike in Tommy John surgeries and Didi Gregorius and even a little Masahiro Tanaka.
We'll be right back.
Okay, we are joined now by Dr. Tommy John, the son of former Yankee Tommy John, who is, of course, very famous in the baseball community. Tommy, thanks so much for coming on and talking with us today.
Guys, thanks for the opportunity. It's my pleasure.
So, kind of interesting timing for this, because we just heard about Didi Gregorius going down with Tommy John surgery. He'll be out until at least May or June, and you were tweeting about the injury and how, you know, the concern around baseball that Cashman addressed Didi's asymptomatic injury that the Yankees knew about before they even made the trade for Gregorius. So do you think something like that asymptomatic injury that Gregorius had while he was with the Diamondbacks, should that have been a bigger concern for the Yankees before pulling the trigger on that trade?
I always think so. And that's just how I view things. You know, it's almost like every hammer is going to look at everything like a nail. A surgeon's going to try to see surgery. Acupuncturist is going to look at, everyone's got their specialty. Mine is to try to find cause of dysfunction, and every injury has clues. Every injury is different per person. And when you have something like a partially torn ligament, which is what he had in 2014, I believe it was, that's a big red flag. That's an only the ingredients there to create that environment that is that symptom aren't going to be addressed. So it's a matter of time before something pops up. I don't care what position you are or what sport you are. It won't matter. So if I were a club and I were investing, it's almost like, think about if it was a Ferrari. If the three of us were going to go ahead and put money into a Ferrari, we'd want to know the accident report. We'd want to see the mileage. We'd want to know if there's sugar in the gas tank. We want to check the tires. But there's more that goes into almost car purchases than it is with these athletes. And really, here's what I think it stems from is, nobody's afraid of the surgery anymore. Nobody's afraid of surgeries in general anymore. It's just, well, you're going to have it. Just get it done and you'll be fine. And that's so far from the truth.
Yeah, and you know, specifically with Didi, given his, not only is he, you know, a good shortstop, he's also a very good hitter. And,
right.
And we've seen players that, I mean, like Xavier Nady comes to mind. He was a good hitter. He had the surgery, and it seemed to affect his hitting, too. He never was a good hitter after that. Does that kind of surgery affect not only your throwing, but also your hitting as well, of position players?
You know what's interesting? It depends which arm more. If I'm a hitter, if it's the bottom hand, like with Shohei,
right.
If it's that, it's a little, I don't want to say easy, but it's a little more doable. There's a little less going into that specific point in the elbow. It doesn't change how you go about coming back from it, but if it's the bottom hand, it's a little easier. If it's the top hand, it's going to be a little tougher. But what has to happen with surgery is you have to rehab twice. You have to rehab once to get back to above the level you were at before the surgery, because before the surgery, you weren't okay. That's what got you injured. So that's part of rehab. Then you actually have to rehab from the trauma, the psychological, emotional, intellectual, and physical trauma of the act of surgery itself. And so that's where it becomes, whoa, this is a big deal. Anytime somebody has any kind of surgery at all, you need to look at it as more than just, well, ligament got repaired, he's good. There's got to be more to it than that.
So like you said, there's a lot of aspects to recovery from something as serious as Tommy John surgery. So exactly how much uncertainty surrounds the recovery time for a position player? Because we've seen a player like TJ Rivera in the Mets organization who still hasn't been able to make his way back. And then you see a former Yankee like Tony Womack who underwent Tommy John surgery, and he was back in almost no time. And that was someone who was in his 30s. So just how much parity is there in terms of position players coming back from this surgery?
That's where we put the body on a timeline, and it's kind of unfair. It took my dad 12 years and one day to come back. Does that mean it's everybody? No, but then you put that guideline on a person. What if they do everything under the sun they're supposed to do in line? They do exactly, and it just took them 18 months just because that's what their body took. Well, now all of a sudden they're negatively looked at, they're not working hard enough, they're not, and so it's tough when you put the body into a timeline. Now, here's the reality of a position player. Pitchers, have it easy, and I want to clear this up because I was a pitcher and I was a middle infielder as well. So pitchers have all the time in the world to get everything set so that they can deliver the most optimal pitch to the most ideal location. They could even take their time and stop mid-delivery and reset, where an infielder has to throw from infinite angles, off shifts of body. Their body's going to be in this infinite positions. They can't just set, you know, that one motion and learn it and go with that. They have to throw from all these angles, body in a better position than others. So that's where the crapshoot comes in from an infielder, because we can't possibly know what the mechanics of the throw are going to be for the infielder. And basic training and rehab, guys, you need to train and rehab at a level of stimulus greater than anything you're going to ever encounter on the field. So that means an off-balance throw off the opposite foot from the deepest pocket, that person has to be, or for him specifically, he's got to be prepared for that. And how do we do that? That's where the randomness comes in. And that's where I think for a position player, I take it just as seriously as a pitcher. I know we're just like, they'll come back in 6 to 9 months. It's less for a position player. I highly disagree because of that randomness that the position itself requires.
Well, that's really interesting. And one Yankee, keeping it with the Yankees, another pitcher who's dealing with a partial tear himself is Masahiro Tanaka. And he's had this since 2015. So in your opinion, is that kind of an outlier, someone who's been dealing with something like that? And, you know, what goes into a procedure where he gets a platelet injection and then for whatever reason, his elbow has been pretty much fine for the past 3 years?
So, and I've sat on in fellow meetings with surgeons on that platelet-rich they were presenting, and it's not even there. Just like, this isn't really that successful. The odds, the percentages aren't great, but we don't have any options. Like, we don't know, and surgeons are trying their hardest to not have to do the surgery. You know, they will really try, especially at that level of baseball. What could we do to get this done now? Here's the reality of when you do something specific to a site, you try to symptom care that site. His elbow is damaged, quote unquote. That's where the symptom showed up. The cause is going to be elsewhere in the body. Somewhere in the body, there's an inability to absorb force properly, sequencing. It's really how we move, the inability to move. Okay, everything's going to go to that point. If we go ahead and try to bypass the normal healing response that the body does to a site, and we get a healing response that the rest of the body didn't have to grow through, you may stabilize an elbow that the rest of the body didn't learn how to create that itself. So now you just made a joint like minusculely more stable. What might happen to the wrist or the shoulder? What might happen to the spinal joints? What might happen to the forearm muscles around it? You don't know. And so it's almost like, when you try to gain this instantaneous, you know, inject or tape or pill or injection or of some kind, the fallout could be body-wide and it lingers. It's almost like a landmine. And you don't know. You may buy yourself some time and then all of a sudden, the biggest explosion you've ever had. And it's like, we bought ourselves, you know, a month or a year or whatever it is. But at some point, you're going to have to meet the maker and put in the work and get to the source. And it's a business. That's the tough part of sports is that it's entertainment and there's a lot of money at stake.
So, you know, you're talking about there's other things that go into this, into these tears, right? So what can pitchers do? Like, let's say Tanaka has a partial tear, or I know Ohtani came over with a partial tear that you know, that was disclosed.
Correct.
What can pitchers do? Let's say they have a partial tear. Is it something in their delivery, a way that they deliver the pitch, where it's like, you know what, you have, you know, a small tear. If you alleviate the stress on your elbow by doing this and that, are there things that pitchers can work on in order to do that, or is it just the way that their bodies are constructed and there's nothing they can really do?
That's such a good question, and we're all, they've been looking for that one thing. They've even asked my dad, what's the thing you did that made you come back and throw 15 or 14 years without missing a start after your elbow surgery? And he doesn't have an answer for that one thing, because it could be a number of things. The single biggest cause of injury is the body's inability to absorb force. The second biggest cause is previous injury. So any previous injury anywhere in the body just changed the mechanics and the physiology and the everything body-wide. So you got to start at the feet, and you got to go to the hands. And I would start feet first. Happened with Verlander. He had his feet analyzed and finally got everything in line, and all of a sudden his shoulder and elbow, and it just bought himself like another 4 years or something. He's never felt better. So I would look at Ohtani, had ankle surgery prior to coming over here. Then shortly after that, he had an opposite quad that exploded. And then he rolls his ankle right before this last flare-up that caused the surgery. So you got to look at everything. You need an injury history body-wide. And you got to deal with previous injuries. And I will say this, the biggest flaw in American strength and conditioning and rehab is our inattention to previous injury. If pain's not there, we don't worry about it. But there's so much dysfunction prior to when pain or tears show up that there's clues that the body leaves. And so it's one of those things. It's bigger than an exercise. It's bigger than mechanics. It's bigger than rest. It's bigger than pitch counts. It's like all of it. It's the food they eat. It's staring at phones. It's video game abuse. Their sleep. You know, everyone's starting to try to see how to get an edge. It's all of it put in together. But every player is different. That's why protocols have a hard time working with something as dynamic as the body, because we try to put something so malleable and never changing as the human body into a protocol, and the body doesn't know, it doesn't work on protocols. Like my dad, for instance, coming back, this is such a great story. Instead of throwing a throwing program coming back, it was like, now it's number of throws, 15 throws at 45 feet, rest, you know, 30 throws at 50 feet, whatever it's going to be. Well, he threw for time. So let's just say 60 feet he was going to throw that day. He'd throw for 7 minutes, where one day, 7 minutes, he might be able to get 42 throws in 7 minutes. And another day, he's just dragging, things are hurting, his elbow's inflamed. Okay, maybe he gets 12 throws, but he still worked for 7 minutes. So there's like that playable guideline where 7 minutes on a mound allows the player to be who they're going to be that day. And that's not the case now. We're trying to like fit everybody into this mold, and that's dangerous because nobody's the same. That's why you get different results with the same protocol.
That's really interesting what you said about it. You know, everything affecting something else. I remember a couple of years ago, Mark Teixeira blew out his quad, and you know, they asked him what happened, and they said, "Well, I had rolled my ankle in the other leg, and it was affecting the way I was running, and I was putting,
right."
And it was kind of like when you were talking about that, I thought about that. I guess what you said kind of negates my next question, but I was going to ask: is there? I mean, we hear about partial tears, full tears.
Yeah.
Is there a point of like no return where it's like it's not even worth looking at it, where you have to have the surgery? Like if it's more than 50% torn, or is that really just case by case?
So that's what's tough, is that, again, we're talking about a business and a career. I have seen and have talked to colleagues in the business where as long as it's intact, if there's connection, meaning it's not totally severed, the fruit's not pulled totally from the tree, right? As long as it's intact, there's a chance that the body will adapt and do its best to recreate and adapt to that environment, but the environment's got to change, and that's the challenge. Is there enough time? Sometimes bodies need a lot of time with something very minor to what we would consider minor. Sometimes bodies need less time to what we would consider major. It is case to case. I'm always, if you can avoid surgery, try to do everything you possibly can to not have to have it. And then you're talking though about maybe a 34-year-old or a free agent or. And there comes those variables that kind of make you, I gotta figure out what I gotta do here, you know, because I've been in rehab and trained a lot of the Chicago Bears, having come from Chicago, and that was the deal. It was like, this is what your body needs to heal, but Monday Night Football doesn't abide by that, you know. So you gotta break some rules, but at some point you hope to catch up with where the body can tip the scale more in its favor.
So you talk about how surgery should be a last resort, but you've also, you know, illustrated on social media and in your work just how much Tommy John surgeries have been on the rise. Just, you know, you look at pitchers today and it's all about velocity and sharp movement on your breaking ball. And the Yankees have a number of pitchers like that. Severino is among the hardest throwing starting pitchers in the league. Dellin Betances and Aroldis Chapman, they all can hit 100 miles an hour. Just how much is the demand for velocity and movement on your off-speed pitches behind the uptick in Tommy John surgeries in terms of those adding more stress on an elbow?
It's definitely the way the game's changed. And then when you look at what is required or demanded or prime for a baseball player, that baseball player has to grow from something. This is the biggest culprit. You got the youth sports industry is $15 billion a year and growing. Growing. That's like more than the NFL pulls in a year. So these players are specializing. They're getting worn out. They're speeding up the process of becoming elite, which elite and youth should never be combined in the same sentence. The good ones are going to make it through, but they just survived. They just survived the process. They just survived the system. But you throw in that business of youth sports, you throw in the American lifestyle, which is get it now. The training is upside down on its head. You're not a good mover. You don't know how to move. You can't stand on one leg, but you can deadlift X number of weight, or you can squat horribly some amount of weight, and your velocity is going to go up because you're just stimulating the body. It's pretty easy to do that, but to sustain that is very, very difficult. So we're increasing ability at the expense of durability, and nobody cares. Just whatever. Just get your speed up and don't worry about it. They'll figure it out at that point. By the time they get to the big leagues, there's so much mileage. There's so much laid down that it's only a matter of time throwing max effort, max velocity, max torque, max spin rate, all that stuff that the body's just finally like, I can't keep up. Now, I will say this, throwing hard, being nasty, there is nothing wrong with that. But it requires a complete different training regimen than the different ones that are being approached now. Like, we have to do things so, I mean, we would just have to restructure everything to be able to sustain that, not just show it for 2 years, but I mean sustain it. And then, you know, that I don't think people are up for that. That's the hard part. I even asked my dad, though. I was like, could you guys back in the day throw harder? He's like, oh, yeah. But that wasn't what the case was. You were supposed to get outs for a long time. And he's like, I could reach back and throw over 90. Gossage could bring it. If Gossage had to throw only one inning, what would that have looked like? You know, like, my gosh. And so a lot of those guys have that in them where I think now they're just tapping into reserves that have always been there. But because youth sports and the training and the nutrition and the stress and the tech and all that stuff is just upside down on its head, that these bodies can't sustain.
All right, we're talking to Dr. Tommy John. He also has a book, Minimize Injury, Maximize Performance. Tommy, really interesting stuff. Thank you so much for coming out and talking with us. I really think people will get a lot out of it.
Anytime, guys, and I appreciate you helping me with my mission.
Thank you.
All right, guys, take care.
All right, that was Dr. Tommy John Jr., really insightful stuff. And like you said at the beginning, Sean, it definitely scares you a little bit because, I mean, he made an incredible point that I never even thought about when it comes to position players recovering from Tommy John surgery and all the different angles that they have to throw from, all in one motion, too. What a great point that, you know, pitchers do have a heavier workload on their arms, but they have time to set, go through their normal motion. I mean, especially shortstops, you know, ranging in the hole, throwing across their body. So much can go wrong. And at the same time, we've also seen so much parity in terms of the recovery time for position players. I mean, I'm sure everyone's hoping for a Tony Womack situation. But, you know, the scary part is just that fear of the unknown because you really don't know when Gregorius will be back.
Yeah, I mean, this is really concerning. And just Didi brings so much to the team, not only just, you know, for his great production, but also he bounces out this right-handed heavy lineup. He's just such a good lefty bat, you know, 27 dingers this year. And you're going to lose that for so long. We're going to get into our wish list next week, but I'm really interested to see what they do there. I really hope this isn't the end of Didi with the Yankees. I really was hoping they'd give him an extension. This is a business. So, you know what, maybe this drives the price down a little bit and they can, you know, offer him, you know, get him on a little bit better of a deal. But I think he's a core piece to keep around. And, definitely one of my top three favorites on the team right now. I mean, you think about what he did to come through and replace Jeter. And I mean, not too many Yankee fans have been missing Derek Jeter in that sense, because of what he's done. But you know, it's definitely scary stuff. And, Dr. Tommy John Jr. made a lot of great points about, you know, how when you have a partial tear, well, there's something that caused it. And, you know, hopefully Tanaka has altered whatever it was that was causing that. And, you know, his pitch usage has changed since the surgery. And hopefully that, that has helped his elbow and will be okay from here. But you never know. And, you know, I think the Yankees made the right choice with Tanaka. When you think about it, him not having the surgery has led to Tanaka pitching in, what are we at, 6 playoff games now? And he's gone at least 5 innings and never allowed more than 2 runs in any of them. So, I mean, I think it's been worth the gamble, even if he had to have the surgery in the middle of the next season.
Yeah, I agree. Great adjustment by Tanaka. I mean, I think he throws the least amount of fastballs in the league now after having to change a little bit of his approach after suffering that injury. People forget just how dominant he was in 2014 before that injury, and he's still turned himself into a nice starter with a great postseason resume. And in terms of Gregorius, it's definitely scary to think about the Yankees without that lefty balance in the lineup, especially because Gregorius and Greg Bird were supposed to be your lefty balances in that lineup, and now both of them are completely up in the air for different reasons. Well, I mean, Bird has had his fair share of injuries as well, but now it seemed like it was more of just a lack of production. Didi, you know you're getting that production. He's gotten better offensively every year, and what seemed like a potential lock for an extension, and your shortstop of the future is now up in the air, and that's scary to think about, but let's get out of the negative real quick. And before we wrap things up, why don't we just revisit our favorite moments from the season before we officially close the book and start looking ahead to the off season and what's to come. But I would imagine we're going to agree on our top moment or game. I would imagine for you, it's definitely the wild card game. I mean, just how that game started with Severino just completely mowing down the A's in that top of the first. And it's funny. It wasn't, you know, specific moment wise, it wasn't anything crazy. But after how he pitched in the wild card game the year before, and just to see how dominant he was in that first inning, that was one of the loudest I've ever heard Yankee Stadium when he got that inning ending strikeout. And then just to have Judge come up the next inning and just hit one to the moon on a frozen rope. It was. I think that first inning of the wild card game was probably my favorite moment.
That's actually my second favorite moment.
Is it because you were at the game for the Stanton walk-off? Is that your favorite?
No, oh, actually, wow, okay. That didn't even make my top. Well, I had a tie for the third place if we were going to do like top three. that's definitely top five if we're going to do top five. But my favorite moment of the season was actually the inning they had where Gardner hit the triple off Kimbrel when they had that big comeback against, mm-hmm. well, not a big comeback, but they had that comeback against Boston. And then Judge, the next batter, hit the solo shot.
To dead center, right?
Yeah, to dead center. The reason that was my top favorite was that was right at the end of that amazing stretch that they had. And that was like, holy shit, this team is unbelievable. And then it started to go downhill after that. Not downhill, but I mean, things kind of definitely normalized after that. But that was like kind of the pinnacle of the season where it was like, this is really, it could be a special year. And I just remember, like, you know, Sterling says, and the place is going nuts. And just like, you know, that was kind of like the peak of the season for me. And it's a shame it happened early, because last year the peak definitely happened later. That wild card game, though, that was amazing. That's definitely number two in my book. And then and I think you captured it perfectly, so I don't even need to go through it again. And then Third and fourth for me, the stay-at-home run was really cool, but when Gardner tied the game with that solo shot against Houston that mm-hmm. just snuck in, and then they won that game in extras, that was definitely a cool moment. And when when they played Houston, they were playing really well at the time, so those games were really intense. And when Sanchez hit the three-run bomb in Houston, that was also another one of my favorite moments of the season.
Yeah, we have a pretty identical list. I also have the rally off Kimbrel. I also have the Sanchez home run. I include the Glaber walk off against Cleveland. That was like
that was a good.
That was at the peak of that incredible run against a bunch of, you know, World Series contending teams, and that was just a crazy game that was capped off by that home run. And you know, in terms of just my favorite storyline, real quick, I just think Luke Voit was the most improbable, enjoyable. It had a it kind of had like a Lynn Sanity feel to it. Just this guy comes out of nowhere and just tears it up on the biggest stage for a few weeks, and it's just such a huge reason why the Yankees even were in position to have that wild card game moment in the Bronx.
Yeah, that was really fun, and I agree that was the most fun kind of little okay, wow, this is really happening streak. All right, curveball just to end it. Favorite gif-able, like, reaction moment thing of the season.
It doesn't even come from a Yankee. It's the gif of Giles punching himself in the face.
All right, nice. That's a good one.
What about yours?
Probably when Shane Robinson got buzzed and CeCe's in the dugout. I'm laughing just thinking about
it. CeCe has a lot of good gifts. Yeah, that's for you bitches up there too.
Yeah, that one's really good. The Giles one's really good. And then the Betances shimmy in the wild card game is also up there. But yeah, what CeCe's face when he's kind of like he's got his chin up and he's that was pretty awesome.
Yeah, that was good. Definitely hope we haven't seen the last of CeCe in pinstripes either. But
let's get to that next week. We'll talk about the plans for next season, and obviously we'll talk about the ramifications of the Didi injury more when we do that, and everything like that.
Yep, that's a good plan. Oh, real quick, we revisited the anniversary of Boone's home run, which technically happened on October 17th. Something else pretty big happened on October 17th, and it's not brought up enough, but it's such an underrated moment of the Yankees.
The Tino Grand Slam.
No. God, that's not an underrated moment. That's huge. The David Justice home run in the 2000 ALCS. I think that's such an underrated moment, and it happened on October 17th, 2000, and he hit that no-doubter into the upper deck and sent the Yankees to the World Series. That was
get
huge.
Get your tokens ready!
I just wanted to bring that up. That's an underrated moment for me.
That was sick. I remember watching that. That was awesome. That team overperformed in the postseason after having a pretty blah regular season. That was a great moment, but the Tino Grand Slam also on the 17th. Actually, the newspaper, I still have it, says Mr. because remember Tino was terrible in the postseason up until that moment.
Mr. October.
It said Mr. October, and then in parentheses it said the 17th or 17th. Yeah. So I still have that that newspaper clipping actually, but yeah.
All right. Well, we've revisited some great moments, and we've closed the book on a season that ended in disappointment, and thanks to Dr. Tommy John Jr. for giving us some valuable insight as to what to expect over the winter, and next week we'll come back and look ahead to that winter as we say goodbye to the 2018 season. And Sean, it's the official end for us of this season, but we're going to be here all winter, and I'll see you next week.
Next week we start to look ahead.
All right, goodbye everybody.
Bye.